It's just about 1 p.m., time for Corporations and Democracy.
Welcome to Corporations and Democracy, where twice a month we explore issues of corporate-dominated society and its effects on democracy. This is Molly Morgan, and today we'll be talking with Richard Moore, author of the new book, Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World. But first, a few announcements. Corporations and Democracy is brought to you today in part by our members and Catalyst, presenting the Ultimate Grants Tool, a hands-on workshop for building grant proposals, plus a two-week pass to Guide to Grants Online, Wednesday, September 20th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's at 207 Pine Street in Ukiah. You can register by calling 462-2984. Corporations and Democracy is also brought to you by Mulligan Books in downtown Ukiah at 208 South State Street. 25,000 books and DVDs gently used and recently recycled by your friends and neighbors. 462-1555, www.tobeofuse.com. On Tuesday, August 22nd, Laura Schatzberg will present a talk with slides on her 2 years as a high school teacher for the Peace Corps in Namibia, Africa. This event will be at the Garcia Grange in Manchester beginning at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. For more information, you can call 882-1901. And on Friday, August 25th, the New Orleans pianist, singer, and songwriter Dr. John will perform a benefit concert for KZYX and Z in Fort Bragg at the Cotton Auditorium beginning at 8 o'clock p.m. Appearing with Dr. John will be his band, the Lower 9-11s, named after New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, which was home to many musicians until it was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. Tickets for Dr. John are available online at kzyx.org, by phone at 800-838-3006, and at Dig Music in Ukiah. Tickets are $60 apiece, and all seats are general admission. Today we're talking about democracy, what some people call radical or deep democracy, and just what that might mean for ordinary people at a local level. From across the entire political spectrum in the United States, there are people today decrying our loss of democracy and urging citizens to take back our country. But there are other voices asserting that we have nothing to reclaim, that we don't live in a democracy and never have. One of those voices is my guest today, Richard Moore. After a long and successful career in the computer software industry, Richard began a new journey in the 1990s with an unknown destination. "I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began," he writes, "but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense." Richard's wide-ranging exploration brought him to the conclusion that we must radically transform society if we are to survive the looming ecological and social crises that confront us today. Over the past decade, he's honed his ideas for why and especially how this transformation must take place. And now they're distilled into his new book, Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World. He joins us today from his home in Wexford, Ireland. Richard Moore, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
Well, hi, Molly. Thanks for that wonderful introduction.
Richard, this feeling that what we're being told doesn't make sense is something that more and more people seem to be experiencing, and you found a provocative metaphor right in the popular culture to explain your insights. So tell us, just what is this matrix from which we need to escape?
Well, I mean, the metaphor, of course, is when Neo takes the red pill and suddenly it's like everything he thought was true is just a fantasy and there's a totally different reality underneath. And if you look at, you know, at history and what's really going on in the world, I mean, we have a mythology that talks about democratic crusades and bringing democracy to the world and freedom to the Iraqis and all of this. And whereas in reality, it's just nothing but imperialist games of acquisition and conquest and exploitation. So it's like a totally different story.
So the Neo that you're talking about is the character played by Keanu Reeves in the movie that came out in 1999, The Matrix, which was
right.
Seen by a great many people, had, I think, two sequels to it.
Yeah.
So that's what you're using for a framing. And so could you tell us a little bit about what you did to inform yourself and how it affected your understanding of people in society?
Well, in my last few years working in industry, listen to books on tape as commuting. So that'd be a book a day. And I found that the only thing that was that I found interesting, to hold my interest, would be history and biographies. And so that was really my college course in history. It was never something I studied in school. And then the time I was starting my writing and investigating was exactly the same time that the Internet came into existence. And people started doing email, and there started to be a World Wide Web. And so that provided an amazingly effective vehicle for communicating with other people. You could, like, join a list of historians, and you could debate with them about different things and learn things. So it was a great educational tool and also a great place to experiment with expressing ideas and get feedback from people. Because normally people don't write to book authors, you know. You might have a best-selling book and get five or six letters, you know. Whereas on the Internet, you write one essay and you get dozens of replies and arguments and debates, and you learn a lot that way.
So you talked to historians, and what other kinds of people did you collect information from, test out ideas with?
Well, whatever I was trying to learn about, then I would find people that were discussing that or were experts on that or had theories on that. So a whole range of, I mean, all kinds of things, sociology, history, anthropology, psychology, you name it. That's all. They all have important contributions to make.
And also different political philosophers.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, you know, all the things like David Corton and all the Michael Chosudowski and all the important people that are analyzing the current situation. All of those, yeah.
So you say that our civilization is based on a great many illusions, and the way you organize your book is that each chapter gives readers an opportunity to peel back a different layer of the deception. Mm-hmm. And two of those layers are about the past. You've got both a brief history of humanity and some rather eye-opening information about world events in the 20th century. But I have to say, Richard, it sure didn't remind me too much of what I remember being taught in high school. Can you give us some of the highlights of those historical sections of the book?
Well, it's the same story many times over. Well, I guess we could take World War I as kind of a good example. In the history books, you learn, oh, there were these unfortunate entangling alliances, and people misestimated each other's intentions, and we accidentally got into this big war, which nobody wanted. Well, the fact is that World War I was planned by the British, and it was an entrapment scenario to keep Germany from becoming a major competitor. America got dragged in because it had done the financing, and if Britain didn't win, then U.S. would be out a lot of money. So, I mean, the stories underneath what really was going on are just so different than what we learn in history that I give a lot of examples of that just to sort of get the general picture across. I don't try to give a complete, you know, alternative history.
And so why do you think that the history that you've uncovered is so different from what we're taught in school?
Well, because what we're taught in school allows us to accept the way the world works as being inevitable or possibly even the right way because we don't know what's really going on. If we really know what's going on, we wouldn't be so cooperative.
And part of the way that we don't know what's going on is because, and I guess I would say, that's probably more true of people in the more privileged societies. Would you agree? Because people who have a lot less benefit from the way the world works are pretty close to the way things work and have a better handle on it.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're, you know, in the third world under the thumb of imperialism, then you kind of know what it's really about. And you don't have much opportunity to do much about it either. So it's the people in the West who need to be the most propagandized so that they can accept the benefits they get without feeling guilty about why they have those benefits.
you say that part of our matrix illusion is that those of us in the West live in free democratic societies, and you even say that representative democracy is actually an adversarial system. Can you explain what you mean by this?
Well, those are kind of two different points. I mean, up until, let's say, when the American Revolution and French Revolution came along, you know, no one would have questioned the fact that the world has always been run by elites, you know, kings or popes or emperors, whatever. I mean, that was obvious. That's just how the world worked. And people were taught to accept their place in the system. You know? Then when the Republican revolutions came along, then the myth was introduced that democracy had been achieved. But in fact, it was just a switch of one set of elites for another set. Now, in order to maintain this illusion of democracy, they have this thing called parties and elections. And those are adversarial systems. They're like games that people win at. So that rather than elections being a vehicle for the people's will to be expressed in government, it's really more an arena in which different politicians sell their talent at hoodwinking populations sort of to the highest bidder, you might say. So, I don't know. Is that kind of the answer you were
looking for? The thing that we could talk a little bit about is you describe this representative democracy system as being adversarial. You also describe two primary ways that people interact in groups. And so maybe that's some of what we can go to, because that's what I certainly see in the public arenas that we're allowed to watch, the cooperative groups that meet and the adversarial ones. So describe what you see about the two primary ways that people meet these days.
Okay, well, there's basically two ways in which people interact, either in parliaments or in meetings or, you know, in doing things. One of them is when they are allies pursuing some common goal. That'd be like a Democratic Party meeting, let's say, planning their campaign. The other is an adversarial, like in a courtroom or a parliament or during the process of an election. Different sides are competing. So what we have then is whatever conflicts exist within that group are not resolved. And we're getting into kind of deep stuff here the way you asked the question. Let's say that in a community there's conflict about how certain things should be done. Well, what happens is people divide up into factions with different answers to the conflict, and then they battle it out to see which answer gets implemented.
Let's use an example. Let's say that there are some builders who want to put in a new complex, and there's a community group that wants to maintain it or have it become a park.
Right. So generally what happens is there's a struggle for influence, and one side or the other wins. What there doesn't usually happen is that the people who want to do the logging and the people in the community sit down and reach a solution that they all agree is the best. That's unlikely to happen in the current situation, because the people who are doing the logging have lots of money and have ways to get what they want, so why should they bother to reach agreement with the local citizens? I mean, that's generally how things happen. There's a third way of people working together, and that is the way of dialoguing and listening to each other's concerns and working together to come up with solutions that they all want. And that is the kind of process which can enable a true democratic society.
And that's what you chose the word harmonization to describe that process. And so why don't you tell us a little bit about it? And if you want, you can tell us you have several stories in the book about where this harmonization process, going by various names, has worked well in communities. Why don't you define it for us first?
Well, we're talking about facilitated group processes. That's where people are together in a room having a session, and there's a facilitator to help them communicate with each other. And there have been this is something that goes on. I mean, it goes on in industry. You know, they have they have sessions in industry to have better team process and all those kind of, that kind of stuff. It's happened in communities and activist groups. And if you look at the experience of these kind of sessions, of course, it's widely varied. They happen for different purposes and under different systems. But there are many instances where people have come together who had radically opposing viewpoints and different values and saw each other as the enemy. And yet, when they were helped to communicate at a deep level and to really listen to each other, listening is really the key, they experienced kind of a breakthrough where they came to see that even though the other people had a way different opinion than they did, they were actually valid human beings who had reasons to feel the way they did. And once that kind of breakthrough occurred, then the whole group began to work together to try to deal with everyone's concerns. And they would, in these real cases that happen in the real world, they'd come up with amazingly creative solutions which served everyone better than anybody's going in propositions or going in positions. So this is something that has happened in many cases, and when the conditions have been set up right, it's pretty much guaranteed to happen. So I find that as a very promising thing, which has been observed in the microcosm.
There are a lot of different facilitation styles, and some of them have been around for a long time. The Quakers, for example, and some of the Native American societies have used consensus processes that have helped people synthesize different ideas and bring them together as a group. Mm-hmm. So there's a history of this, but it's enjoying a resurgence. But I will say I've been to an awful lot of meetings where there is no one acting as a facilitator, both in business situations and in activist meetings. And it makes a big difference if somebody is there to help bring out the best of everyone.
Oh, it makes an incredible difference. And I mean, I've only been through the experience personally a few times. I've observed it more than that and read about it and, you know, talked to people that are in the business. But one of the times I did experience it was just like things had reached a terrible impasse where, you know, we didn't even know what to say next. You know, it was just a complete loss as a meeting. And then somebody stepped in and just started asking some simple questions. We're like, well, why are you here really? And why did you come? And what are you trying to accomplish? And this kind of things. And that just opened up a whole new dimension of understanding and communication. And the whole spirit of the room changed instantly. So it's a subtle but powerful thing, you know, getting people to actually hear each other and to actually listen.
Part of the challenge is that people walk into meetings with a lot of assumptions about other people, about themselves, and they respond from that level. And if they can step back from it and really look into what's motivating them, the kinds of questions that you just described, why are you here, then people can talk at a different level than where they usually are when they're arguing with each other.
Yeah. Now, this is something which is, let's say, well understood in the facilitation community and the group process community and, in that arena. And really what I've been doing in developing the ideas in the book is thinking about how those proven processes could be applied to actually create an ongoing sense of democracy and democratic participation in society. And what became clear to me is that for that to work, it's got to start at the local level. Because at the local level, like in a neighborhood or a small community or whatever, one can see how if people in the community were invited to participate in these kinds of sessions, say on a rotating basis or a continuing basis, it would be possible to develop a sense of the community and a sense of how the community wants to deal with certain issues and a sense of mutual understanding where there formerly may have been, you know, the good side of the tracks and the bad side of the tracks, that kind of thing. And one could actually see the possibility of the emergence of a truly democratic process on a local level. But that depends on the fact that it's small enough that achieving that consensus becomes possible. When you start trying to do this kind of thing on a national scale or a very large scale, it just then you get back into the representative paradigm. Whereas if we talk about a process of listening and dialogue on a community level, it doesn't need to be representative. It can be participatory by everybody, and with everybody's voices being heard in the decisions that are made.
Since we're talking about the kinds of changes that we appear to be facing as a species and as a planet, it makes sense to talk about that from an activist viewpoint, especially here in Mendocino County, where there are a lot of people already hard at work who are paying attention to making our communities more locally sustainable. And we have people working on peak oil and economic localization and food, water, energy, different kinds of development, either supporting it or challenging it. And one of the questions that I have is, so people are already engaged in this work. Many of them understand how these issues are connected to each other. What kinds of things could these groups do to have their work enhanced by your ideas?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think what it takes is kind of a shift in perspective. Continuing along the same lines of what people are doing, but with a slight shift in perspective. And let me say a little more about what I mean. One of the shifts would be not to focus so much on those who are ready to respond to these kinds of initiatives. In other words, other activists and politically minded people and progressives and all that. It's easy to work with them and get them involved, da da da. But in order to move toward a inclusive democratic process, the focus should be more on reaching out to those who normally wouldn't get involved in activism or maybe are conservative-minded or, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
To bring them into the dialogue, not to try to indoctrinate them to progressive ideology, not at all, but to listen to their side of the story and be open to their concerns and to be integrate their concerns into the various active agendas and programs. So that emphasis on inclusiveness rather than working with those that it's easiest to work with is one shift that I think would be very important. Another shift would be to not see the individual activist initiatives as being the goals in themselves. In other words, it's not so much whether you succeed in getting more people to recycle or not whether you succeed in getting more people to bicycle or whatever kind of program you've got going, but rather to see the real progress is in people seeing themselves empowered to take initiatives, not under the direction of activists, but under their own initiative, with activists thinking of themselves more as facilitators rather than leaders.
Which might be a different skill set than a lot of activists have, although there's no reason why people can't develop that. And there are lots of facilitation trainings that people can get access to, and you include some information about some of those in your book. But I can imagine what some people would say in response to what you've just described. People say, you know, we're not the problem. It's those people who are the problem. They dismiss anti-war efforts and say, you know, human beings are naturally violent. We've always had war. And people look around at the world today, especially what they hear on the news, and they, even if they just think about their combative neighbor or their sneaky coworker, and it's really easy for people to fall into this us versus them and overcome the challenge of saying, how do you invite these people who may look at the world pretty differently into our conversation?
Oh, that's another very good question. And it brings up another shift that I would recommend. And that is that if you're going to start talking about Iraq and religion and economic theory or whatever, then you're not going to get any agreement. The shift would be to focus more on local issues and things that local people can do something about, because it's there that the experience of empowerment and solidarity are most easily achieved. Even though there may be somebody that you never in a million years would agree with about Iraq, for example, they might agree with you very much that it's worth putting some work into building a new park for the kids, or, you know, or solving traffic problems in a new way, you know, local things. And even though it may seem, okay, copping out on the big issues in the short run, if people can learn to work together as a community and understand each other as human beings and communicate with each other and solve problems together, then they can gradually move on to broaden the areas of mutual understanding and agreement. So I think emphasizing the strategic importance of a local focus, even though we know in the long run there are world issues that need to be dealt with, I think that's an important shift strategically.
This sense of empowerment, I think, is key, and I want to talk more about that. For right now, I'd like to let those of you who are just joining us know that you're listening to Corporations and Democracy on KZYX and Z. And my guest is Richard Moore, author of Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World. This book is not being distributed through major chain stores, but folks in Mendocino County can purchase this book at the Four-Eyed Frog in Wallala, at the Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino, at Leaves of Grass in Willits, and at the Mendocino Book Company in Ukiah. And it's also available from 100 Fires Books in Eureka. So,
And it's on Amazon and Libris and those online places.
And people can find out about that if they go to your website, which is?
EscapingTheMatrix.org.
Yes, easy to remember. empowerment. Let's talk just a little bit more about that, and then let's bring some listeners in. I feel like that's one of the key points in your book, is people feeling empowered to make the decisions that affect their lives, which is at the core of democracy. What kinds of things do you think people need to do to really sense that empowerment, or is this community building probably the best place to start?
Well, let me mention a couple experiences, events. There was something in Ashland.
Ashland, Oregon. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was called the Rogue Valley Wisdom Council. And this was something that was initiated by a couple, two or three or four activists, community activists in Ashland, after they heard talks by Jim Ruff and Tom Attlee on their community radio. Now, Jim Ruff and Tom Attlee are both people that are very much into deep democracy and what Tom Attlee calls co-intelligence and group wisdom and that kind of stuff. So they invited Jim down to use the dynamic facilitation method, which is one of the methods, which is a pretty good one, and use that and do one of these things he calls a wisdom council in Ashland. And what that involved was selecting people randomly in the Ashland area or the Rogue Valley area and getting them to participate for, what was it, two or three or four days of facilitated dialogue. Now, there was no agenda. There was no topic they needed to discuss or any goals they were supposed to achieve. It was just, okay, you guys, let's just sit down. Let's talk about whatever you want to talk about. In the context of your community, you know. And just by listening to each other and expressing themselves and their own creativity that got evoked, they came out of it with this strong sense, and they were using the phrase, we the people. They just felt by the way they starting out as people that didn't know each other and had radically different beliefs, whatever, whatever, they ended up feeling like a family, you might say, in some sense, and feeling that they had the power as a group to reach mutual understanding, and that they were we the people, and that this kind of thing should have a direct role in the democratic process. So they really came up, in some sense, with a radical political attitude, which they framed as we the people, just by the process of this kind of dialogue.
So it's,
that was a feeling of empowerment.
Mm-hmm. And then people can build on that. So I'd like to invite listeners to join us in this conversation with Richard Moore. The numbers to call are 895-2448 or 800-499-7117. And we have a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Hello. This is Mystery. You're saying, Richard, that a person should be a big cog in a small wheel, rather than a small cog in a big wheel, sort of. Correct?
Well, you mean in terms of participatory democracy?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more, it's not so much about wheels and cogs. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. It's more seeing ourselves as being part of a community,
right,
in which working together is the best way to get the best thing for everybody.
Yeah, so
and
we're
so
trying
it's being part of a group, part of a community, part of a team, more than being a cog in a wheel.
Right. Mendocino County is trying to do that in a lot of little groups, and the thing I like is town meetings. I'm from New England, and so in New England we have pretty good handle on local politics and what happens, and I wondered if you're familiar with town meetings and how all the people are able to participate. The people vote rather than the supervisors.
Well, I think a town meeting is a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem of scale, of course. As the town gets bigger, it's harder to have a meeting, and it's harder for everybody's voice to be heard.
Well, that's true.
But it's certainly better than not having town meetings.
Right, yeah. Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for the book.
Thank you.
So, Mystery brought up an interesting point about how that she framed it as cog in a wheel. To me, reflects some on this issue of empowerment and how people see themselves. I'm thinking of asking you this question. I don't want to lose the empowerment, but you talk about electoral politics. For me, this helps understand a little bit why people have some of the resistances they do to participation. You talk about electoral politics in the book as a kind of tar baby, this irresistible but essentially non-responsive system where the more we engage, the more stuck and immobilized we become. And in fact, one of the stories that you relate was probably the biggest actual democratic movement in the history of the last century, which was the populace, the 19th century.
Right.
And you know, thinking about electoral politics this way, that the more we engage, the more stuck and immobilized we become, it's not something that's going to sit very well with the listeners who believe this is how civilized people solve problems and change things for the better.
Well, that's why the book has chapter one. In other words, you know, in some sense, the point of the book is about, community solidarity and this harmonization process and participatory democracy and all that. That's what it's really about. But the first 50 pages are all about history and political systems and elite deception, etc., because people need to understand that the farce that the electoral system is before they'd be motivated to seek alternative solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know that, it runs deep, this belief that democracy exists, and it's programmed into us so thoroughly that it's a hard one to get through.
That's one of the reasons why the Matrix is such a provocative metaphor. We've got another caller.
Good.
Caller, you're on the air. Hello? Oh, sorry, we lost them. If you're still listening, please call back. The numbers again are 895-2448 or 800-499-7117. Well, let's talk a little bit about the transformational movement that you're envisioning, because that's where you go to in your book. You say that it wouldn't be characterized by a program or a platform, that no matter how noble, platforms are ultimately divisive and usually give rise to opposition movements. And so we've been talking about process, but what it sounds like to me is that you're talking about a movement that's a process rather than a plan of action or a call to change something specific that's wrong, like slavery. So do you think that a movement that's a process is something that's too abstract for people? I'm thinking, especially here in the United States, we have this strong tradition where you're supposed to stop, John, and roll up your sleeves and get down to work, do something.
Well, what I'm trying to do in the book is extrapolate what could be possible if certain initiatives were undertaken in terms of community empowerment.
Richard, can I get you to hold your thought for just a moment?
Sure.
We've got a caller. Go ahead, caller.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering, is the scope of what Richard's thinking of purely in terms of our representational system of government, or does it pertain to something wider like Daniel Quinn in terms of how we actually are collectively living, housing, feeding ourselves, etc.?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, the thing about democracy is that that's what enables us to get on with making, doing sensible things in our society. I mean, as long as we're run by elites, then society is going to be run for elite benefit. In order for societies to be run for human benefit, the first step is that people need to start being the ones to make the decisions about their own lives.
Your focus is primarily on a move to egalitarianism and how we can achieve that.
It talks a lot about economics and transition process to a sensible world and what that would probably look like and how we would deal with maintaining peace and dealing with rogue societies and all that stuff. I mean, it tries to be as comprehensive as it can. It's just that the realization of genuine democracy is kind of the enabling factor. It's the factor that needs the most attention.
Thanks for calling. We've got another.
All right, thank you.
We've got another call. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi there. This is Jack Hayward on Greenwood Ridge. Thanks for your program. And I'm really glad to hear this particular program. I agree that the only salvation for most people is through localizing through their local communities. And I am, and particularly in local matters, I'm totally against electoral or partisan politics. They don't help in the locale. I live in Anderson Valley. And we do have organizations here. We have probably an organization for every citizen in the valley. There are so many of them. I feel that if you focus locally on local issues and leave aside the national issues, which you can't do anything about locally, that's not to say you don't continue to work on them. You focus locally, and you focus on common problems locally. My big thing now is the condition of the county roads. Now, I think this is something that people should be dealing with locally. I really appreciate hearing the program that is spelling out the imperative to follow this route, and I really thank you a lot.
Thanks for your call, Jack. We have another caller. Caller, you're on the air. Hello? Did we lose him?
Yes, we lost another one.
Richard, nope. Hello? You have another one. Go ahead.
Molly, this is Mary D. I don't want you to get through the hour without a response to your question about empowerment. So as a listener, can you go for it?
Sure.
Okay. and address it again to Moore?
You mean you want Richard to talk some more about empowerment?
Yeah, the question you brought up just a few.
Yes, I'm
dying to hear that.
Okay.
Okay.
Let me take another caller first. I'm making a note. We will get back to it, Mary D. Go ahead, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, great show, Molly. Thanks a lot. It's Deborah. One of the callers prompted me to call because as someone who does work extensively locally and listening to that caller say that we can't do anything about the bigger picture, I find myself in a conundrum about things like the nuclear reality and prevalent depleted uranium in the world airstream, and I'd like to have your guest speak about that in terms of empowerment, of how do we empower ourselves to face our global climate change issues, these very big picture issues that aren't necessarily restricted to our own nation or our own governing forces, and how he's come to think about the contrast between the local work and facing these very large-scale realities. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling. Deborah, go ahead, Richard.
Well, I mean, the plain truth is that there's nothing we can do under the current system about any of those big issues. With all of our environmental movement and whatever, things are steadily getting worse. Those are important issues, and we have to get to them, but we're not getting to them at all now. So we've got to face the fact that it's a long haul. We've got to first figure out how people can be the ones to make the decisions in society before we can think about making those big decisions.
So this might be a great time to segue back to Mary D's request for talking more about empowerment, because this is a way it starts, and some of these issues that Deborah brought up are huge issues, and frankly, they disempower a lot of people just thinking about them. It's such an overwhelming challenge.
Well, I think one of the most important things about empowerment is the discovery that it's not about personal empowerment at all. It's about collective empowerment. And the we the people feeling that came out of the Rogue Valley Wisdom Council, and that same thing happened in some other similar sessions, by the way, elsewhere, where people spontaneously came up with this phrase, we the people. And so their empowerment was the empowerment of realizing that they could act in harmony collectively. Because when you realize that that's possible, then you're talking, it's a community that becomes empowered, not each individual.
And
that's hard. That's one that needs to be experienced to be appreciated, because it goes against our conditioning.
Can you
We're taught so much to value the individual and be afraid of groups and things that you have to actually experience it before you realize that it is personally empowering at the same time as being collectively empowering.
And sorry for interrupting you. You talk about that some in the book. I wanted you to say a little bit more about how we evolved as a species and why you say that personal transformation is inextricably bound up with social transformation.
Well, you mix two things in there. Okay, one thing to notice is that human beings have been genetically exactly like we are now for about 100,000 years. So if you took a baby from 100,000 years ago and raised them today, you wouldn't know the difference. Whereas this civilization thing and hierarchy has only been around for about 6,000 years. So for 94% of our existence as we are now, as people, we lived in small hunter-gatherer societies, and we know quite a bit about those societies, partly from archaeology and partly because some still exist. And because of economics and whatever, these were all egalitarian societies and pretty much operated on the basis of consensus, contrary to what Western movies tell us about American Indians. So And if we look at these, a lot of these still existing societies, we find that they tend to have processes, listening processes, where people get together in their sweat lodges or wherever it is, and their peace pipes and whatever their paraphernalia is, and listen to each other and come to an understanding of the wisest path for the community. So our heritage, our evolution, and most of our existence socially has been as part of a close-knit, collaborative, cooperative, egalitarian community where everybody cooperated for the mutual benefit of the group, while at the same time excelling as individuals in whatever, you know, and competing as individuals in various ways. But the focus was on being part of a supportive community. That's kind of our nature. And that's why our society, in which we're isolated in dog-eat-dog competitivism and everybody for themselves, is extremely alienating and stressful, because it's totally contrary to our natures.
And so that's one of the things that you talk about, is that the transformation that we need to make is a social one.
Yeah, I think...
because we are social creatures.
We need to find a way to map our social heritage of cooperative communities into the context of modern technology and communication and large population, et cetera, et cetera. So in some sense, it's going back to our heritage, and in another sense, it's going forward to a new vision.
I'd like to invite people to call. The numbers again are 895-2448 or 800-499-7117. One of the topics you addressed, we've got a call. Let's go ahead. Caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi there. I love the show. I'm going to get the book, too. But I wanted to know if you think that the ruling elite follow this pattern. Do they get together and have a powwow? I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think, I don't know if I used that in the book, but I've used it in other things I wrote, that it's like elites have more or less found a way to put themselves into a collaborative community. There are certainly hierarchies and competition within that. But there's a lot more consensus and mutual cooperation among elites than there are among people. I mean, you know, divide and conquer is, you know, an age-old way of managing people. And so if we can be divided into left and right and Christian and non-Christian and pro this and against that, then it keeps us disempowered.
And in fact, we have an example of the elite powwows pretty near here in the annual Bohemian Grove gatherings. We've got a couple more callers. Caller, you're on the air.
It's funny you should mention the Bohemian Grove, because I was going to say the elites do get together on a regular basis. It's called the Bohemian Grove. It's called the Masonic Lodges. It's called a lot of things, and they're counting on the rest of us not to be organized. They're counting on us to be individuals in our cars. They're counting on the legislature to pass laws that talk to all of us as a big group, yet they don't want big groups to talk to them. They want us as individuals to be able to talk to them, and they want it to remain so, that the individual is how the citizenry should address the government and the ruling elite. And until we get together and organize, it'll never be anything different. And we just got to remind ourselves that the ruling elite does get together and does meet and are organized, and we're way behind. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
How much more time do we have?
We've got about 10 more minutes, and we've got another caller. Can you take the call first?
There's a couple points I want to be sure and make.
Okay.
Before we're done.
All right. If you want to hold them, then we just take this call, and then we can hold calls for a moment, since we've got somebody on the line.
Tell them to speak up, because it's
hard to hear.
The voice level goes way down when you go to a caller.
Okay. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Is it Molly?
Yes.
Joe Jaffe in San Diego.
Hello, Joe.
Hi.
There's a new thing on the horizon for empowerment. People, their clean election laws have been passed in the states of Maine and Arizona. And this gives anybody who can collect enough signatures and funding of $5 a person can get to run for an office and have their money matched in by the state. What does Richard think of that?
Go ahead, Richard.
I don't think that it helps much, unfortunately. The thing I wanted to get to was...
So, do you want to say a little bit more about why, Richard?
Well, it's still within the election system. It still doesn't involve people getting together and working out agendas for society. It's still a representative thing, and then these people go off to the state house or wherever it is and find there's these old boy networks, and you have to juggle to get on a committee, and you have to trade favors, and you know, you just get, it's, again, it's the tar baby thing. It's just a way to suck people's energy into the system.
Why don't you go into the other points you wanted to make sure we didn't lose?
Well, yeah, I wanted to put together something about both empowerment and about my recommendations for activism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to, I want to put forward the notion of what an empowered community would look like. And so envision a community which has considerable division and disagreement within itself and different factions. And if by having a series of these Wisdom Council kind of events, it would be possible to get that community to come together and break through those differences and achieve a sense of community solidarity and a common agenda and commonness of purpose, I anticipate that that would be a very powerful event. For one thing, it would be somewhat unprecedented. And it would be something I think would be very inspiring to other communities. So what I really want to see happen is that some number of activists would turn their energy toward arranging that kind of scenario by, you know, finding some facilitators and doing some local publicity and some organizing to have a series of these Wisdom Council-style events. And I think that if that happened even in one community, that there would be a whole lot of creative energy released out of that community as people who used to be enemies begin to combine their talents. And that generally leads to creative new ideas. I think that would be a powerful precedent that would then inspire similar activity in other communities. And that really would be the nature of the kind of movement I was talking about. There's no platform with respect to any particular political agenda because it's really about people discovering their own agenda.
As a community.
Yeah, exactly.
And certainly Mendocino County is a right place for that kind of work to happen because we already have so much awareness here and we have a lot of activities here. And there's no reason why activists can't become the facilitators themselves, acquire those skills, and mm-hmm. bring that into the communities.
And if only a few do it, then we'll know from that experience how worthwhile it is, and it'll sell itself if it works.
Mm-hmm. And you say in the book that you think that funding should not be terribly difficult to find if there are some communities that want to host events like the Wisdom Council that they did in Oregon.
Yeah.
Or the...
All you need is a place to meet and some community people that want to participate, and then the facilitator is the one person that probably needs to be brought, you know, paid for, in fairness. And then even that might become a volunteer thing if motivated activists learn to be facilitators.
I'd like to remind listeners that they're listening to Corporations and Democracy on KZYX and Z. My guest is Richard Moore, author of Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World. And the book isn't available through major bookstores, but if you're here in Mendocino County, you can get it at the Four-Eyed Frog in Wallala, at Gallery Bookshop in Mendocino. Leaves of Grass in Willits, and the Mendocino Book Company in Ukiah, and just up the road, you can get it at 100 Fires Books in Eureka. And we can take maybe one or two more calls if you'd like to call 895-2448 or 800-499-7117. Richard, did you get to all the points that you wanted to make sure you included?
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to tie those threads together.
All right. Then I'd like you to address another topic that you addressed recently in your online forum, and maybe you can actually start off by inviting listeners to join that. The question was, are human beings naturally competitive and aggressive?
Well, that's a relative question. I was talking before about how 94% of our history was in these hunter-gatherer groups. Now, what you tended to have there, important part of the way the societies and economies operated was through territoriality. So there'd be lots of fighting and raids and stealing horses and, you know, whatever, between territories. But what there wasn't was conquering and enslaving other territories. That didn't happen. I mean, a stronger group might displace another and push them out of their green pastures, and that happened. And there would be raids and mutual, killing each other and that kind of thing. But there wasn't conquest. That's something that came along with hierarchy and agricultural societies. There's certainly competition and violent kind of things in human societies. But that's different than warfare and conquest and enslavement. That's really a civilization thing rather than a human nature thing.
So, and a cultural thing. So we can be competitive and aggressive, or we can be cooperative, and those different aspects of our natures can be nurtured in different kinds of cultures, and we have the choice.
Oh, yeah. There's whatever culture you're raised in. I mean, that's the thing about humans is they're infinitely adaptable. Every society you've ever heard of, no matter how weird it was or whatever, you know, that was people just like you and me raised in a different culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's been very peaceful cultures and very cooperative cultures and very warlike cultures. And human nature is really the ability to fit with any of those. And so it's time we took charge of the situation and created cultures that nurture the values that make sense.
So that's a good note to wrap up on. Richard, can you tell folks if they'd like to continue the dialogue with you? You have an extensive online forum. How do they contact you?
Well, there's two websites. One of them is escapingthematrix.org, which focuses on the book. And the other one is cyberjournal.org, which has more links into the kind of things I'm doing and the email lists that people participate in. And there's ways to subscribe. In both websites, you can easily send me a message.
Richard, I'd like to thank you for being on Corporations and Democracy today.
Well, thank you, Molly. I really appreciate the work you put into this. And, that Mendocino area there seems like a real hotbed for positive possibilities.
We look forward to you coming to see us when you come across the pond next time.
Well, that shouldn't be in more than a month or two.
That sounds great. All right, this is Molly Morgan, and my guest today has been Richard Moore, author of the book Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World. For more information and to participate in the dialogue with Richard, you can go to www.escapingthematrix.org. And before signing off, I have a couple of announcements for upcoming events. On Tuesday, August 22nd, Laura Schatzberg will present a talk with slides on her 2 years as a high school teacher for the Peace Corps in Namibia, Africa. This event will be at the Garcia Grange in Manchester beginning at 7 p.m. It's free and open to the public. For more information, you can call 882-1901. And on Friday, August 25th, the New Orleans pianist, singer, and songwriter Dr. John will perform a benefit concert for KZYX&Z in Fort Bragg at the Cotton Auditorium beginning at 8 p.m. Appearing with Dr. John will be his band, the Lower 9-11s, which is named after New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward. It was home to many musicians until it was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. Tickets for Dr. John are available online at kzyx.org, by phone at 800-838-3000. 3006 and at Dig Music in Ukiah. The tickets are $60 and all seats are general admission. You've been listening to Corporations and Democracy, and it's been brought to you in part by our members and Mulligan Books in downtown Ukiah at 208 South State Street. 25,000 books and DVDs, gently used and recently recycled by your friends and neighbors. 462-1555, www.tobeofuse.com. Corporations and Democracy is also brought to you by Catalyst, presenting the Ultimate Grants Toolkit, a hands-on workshop for building grants proposals, plus a two-week pass to Guide to Grants Online. Wednesday, September the 20th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. It's at 207 Pine Street in Ukiah, and you can register by calling 462-2984. Stay tuned for Jim Hightower and the Hoodoo Dance Party.
You are tuned to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, and 88.1 FM Fort Bragg.